Welcome to Lost and Starting Over with Linda Ballesteros. Death, sickness, unemployment, sadness, depression, divorce. Do you feel like you're alone in any of this? Well, you're not. Together we can find a way out. Get ready for Lost and Starting Over, a show on the Tough Talk Radio Network. Now here's your host, Linda Ballesteros.
Hey folks, welcome to Lost and Starting Over. This is your host today, Linda Ballesteros, and I thank you so much for being with me. You know, as I always say at the top of the show, I always appreciate when someone spends time with me. This time is that one commodity that you get back. So if you're sitting down with someone for coffee or lunch or just sitting down to chat, be sure to know that they're back. So thank them and be grateful. You know, the show Lost and Starting Over is something that's very dear to my heart because I lost my husband recently. And what I notice is that whether it is through death or whether it is the loss of a job or whether it is the loss of a marriage or maybe your financial freedom, there is a grieving process that we all go through. Now, today's guest, Beverly Adamo, she experienced this particular loss quite. You see, she is a dream coach, she's a true purpose coach, and an ordained minister, but she experienced life, death, and rebirth from the unique and inspiring experience of her husband, Rick, dying in her arms and then fighting back to life. And he fought back for his life for three reasons, and she'll talk about that because that is part of her book. But when you look at her story, when you hear her story, you will hear her talk about how she lost life. And many of us don't go through this. My father had Alzheimer's, and I said we lost him. But Bev actually did lose her husband to death twice. So I want you to help me welcome my friend, Beverly Amano. Bev, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Linda. So happy to be here.
Oh, absolutely. You know, your story is such a unique one. And, you know, in your book, you talk about how you lost your husband the first time and how he's truly fought back and fought back hard to come back to this world. So tell me a little bit about the story of your husband's death that you talk about in your book, and tell me a little bit about what happened next. How did he come through that?
Well, he and I, along with our daughter and my mom, were at a jazz cafe listening to music, and he literally just laid his head down on the table, and I ran over to him and I leaned him back and I said, Rick, stay with us. And at that moment I felt his spirit leave. If you've ever, you know, those of us who've experienced being with a person in transition, it's more than just a lost breath. It's really their essence that leaves. And so I saw it, I felt it, I was there as it left. So as we went through the motions of, you know, getting him, calling the EMTs and getting into the ambulance in the hospital, we knew he was gone. And when we arrived at the hospital, it was about 44 minutes after he died, someone came out and said, you know, we've been able to get his heart restarted. He's not breathing on his own, but his heart's restarted. And I was shocked, absolutely shocked. And what occurred to me was that he had, because it was such a sudden death, and for him, you know, great thing. He was here one moment and gone the next. But for everyone else, it was so sudden that perhaps his heart was restarted so we'd have a chance to say goodbye. And yet, in the time frame, the 3 days from when they got his heart restarted to when his essence really came back into his body, I watched him go through this heroic, truly heroic effort to come back to us. And then over the course of time in his recovery from all of that, I realized that there were three reasons that he came back. And the first is love, because our daughter was only 15 at the time, so he came back for love. And then there was music, because he's always been this amazing musician and he needed to come back to record the CD. And then there was the San Francisco Giants, because this was January 2010 when he died, and I realized halfway through the baseball season that the Giants, for the first time in 52 years, were going to win the World Series. I just knew, Giants fan that he was, that was the kicker for being there. And it was so miraculous, and we really spent the next 3 years that he was with us exploring, you know, the miracles and the magic of all of that. And that's what that first book, The Three Reasons, is about. And then in December of 2013, we realized that it was his final time to go. And so the next book that I'm writing is called The Fourth Reason, and it's really going to be the story of that transition as well, because I think there's a lot to be shared with the world in terms of what death is and how it can be viewed and how we can really evolutionize some of the ways that we look at death and loss.
You know, Bev, do you think that in 2010, would you call that, you know, what we've heard before called as a near-death experience? And did he remember anything and come back any different than he was as the man that you knew him prior to that?
Great questions. And I actually talk about his experience not as a near-death experience, but as a death experience, because his soul left the body, and because it was gone for 3 days. Like, literally, his soul was not in his body, even though his heart was beating and the machines were breathing for him. He was not there. It was 3 days before he returned. So I refer to that experience as a death experience. And when he first came back, one of the things that I talk about in the book that was a surprise to me once I read what he wrote about his experiences was how terrifying it was to be back in his body. Not terrifying from that we were scary to him or anything like that, but just, you know, he'd been out in infinity and now he was back in this small little box called a body, and how it was like, it's like, who are these people? So it was quite an interesting experience of him reorienting back to this world, and that's another reason why I call it a death as opposed to near death, because it took him a little bit of time to reorient to, you know, who he was and who he is now. And I would say that there were some interesting differences. For example, when he died in January 2010, he had really bad arthritis. He was even on morphine because of the pain there. And when he came back, one of the things that he could do that just tickled me was he was able to make a fist, because the arthritis in his hands was so bad when he died that he couldn't even close his fingers, make a fist. And yet, once he came back, that's one of the things that he could do. I mean, he easily moved his fingers around, and the pain that was there before wasn't there when he came back. And as far as him remembering the experience, yes, absolutely. He talked a lot, and I put this in the book. When he first got back, he talked to me about some of the experiences of where he went, you know, of who he saw, of what happened to him. And then as we went along in the years after that, he was able to access more of what actually happened to him while he was out of his body, while he was dead, and conversations with God, or more of God telling him about what, you know, what, why he came back and, you know, what he was here to do then. So it was really amazing, really miraculous. And again, I felt so honored that I was able to, as challenging as some of those experiences were and as challenging as the recovery was, I still had this amazing opportunity to be with someone and to witness the miracles of, you know, dying and coming back, and the, you know, the fact that there's not as much difference between, you know, us being alive and us being dead, that it's really our spirit that takes us through those, that lasts and is there through everything. So it's really amazing, and I still feel, every time I think about it, I get chills, because it is such an honor to be a part of a miracle.
You know, Bev, I believe, and I feel the same way. I've been fortunate and blessed to have been at the bedside of several of my relatives, and one of them being my husband, when they actually made their transition. And it is a privilege to be there when someone takes their last breath on this earth and, you know, just crosses over. How, as a wife, how did you sit through those 3 days and you knowing that his body is there and they are medically keeping his body functioning, but you know his spirit is not there? What did you do in those 3 days to either give you hope or to just sit through that process until his spirit did return?
You know, from the moment that he died in the cafe, I felt myself shift into this place. I don't want to call it, it wasn't an unfeeling place. It was simply a place of faith, because I've always been a woman of faith, not a religious person per se, very spiritual, and knowing that everything happens for a reason. So I was in this space of being a witness to everything that was going on. And I knew everything that was happening was for a reason. So I was able to stay in this place of unconditionality, not judging it. Even though there were things that you know, happened, and people that I was talking to, and the doctors would come in and they had no good news for me. You know, it was all about, well, he'd been without oxygen for 44 minutes. You know, how does a person survive that? Well, you know, and his heart's been really damaged. How does a person survive that? So it was 3 days of getting mostly bad news from people, the neurologist, the cardiologist, anyone who was there. And yet at the same time, I was able to just be there with that. And I was talking to him the whole time, because one of the things that the emergency room nurse said to my daughter and I as she left to go get his room ready right after he died was, the nurse said, talk to him, he can hear you. And so we did. We my daughter, my mom, all the people who came to see him, even in his comatose state, we talked to him. We talked to him as though he was there, because I really believe that. And I could feel him still there. So even though he wasn't, his essence, his soul, whatever you want to call it, wasn't in his body, I could feel him there. And not so much like hovering over, like sometimes I've seen or I've listened to near-death experiences of, you know, the spirit being like right there above the body. It didn't feel like that. And yet at the same time, I knew he wasn't completely like disappeared, you know, completely dead, if you will. So it was all about just talking to him and going with it and seeing, you know, seeing what was going to happen, because that was the other thing. Every time they said, you know, he's okay, you better prepare yourself because he's going to die any minute. Every time they said that, he didn't. So it was just being willing to be in the moment, to know that he was still around somewhere, even if it wasn't in this body, and to love him and to love my daughter. I mean, that to me, that was the most important thing for both of them, is to simply be there, love them, love myself enough to allow myself to experience what was going on and not, you know, not be numb or anything like that. Really be willing to be present for this amazing events, whatever they were going on, even though I didn't really understand them at the time.
You know, Bev, I've explained this to and described this to some of my close family and friends that as Mario was on his journey, it was several years, in the last few months, certainly the last few weeks, were a challenge for all of us. I felt as though that whole experience was between Mario and his God, and I was there to support in whatever way I could as he made the agreement with his God to make this happen. We all die at some point, and those around us that love us, the only thing that they can do is really support us as we go through it. You can't really change destination, especially when the agreement is between that person and God. That's out of your control. So how do you maintain a healthy body? Because that's a challenge. When someone's a caregiver, someone's going through a stressful situation like this, how do you take care of
yourself? That's and great point, Linda. I want to emphasize what you said about the fact that this is a soul contract between the person and their God. Because at one point, the doctors did come to me and say, look, what do you want to do? We can either keep him going like this, or we can, take him off of the breathing machine. And I didn't even hesitate because I said, I knew him and I knew he didn't want to be hooked up to, he hated being hooked up to stuff. And so I told him we have to unplug him from the machines. And I was very clear. And I said almost the same thing that you did, was that this is between Rick and his God, Rick and his maker. And it's not up to us. And it's what it is up to us is to support him in doing that. And I know one of the counselors there had talked to me right afterwards, and he said I deal with a lot of people in these situations, and sometimes the family, it's hard for them to understand that this is a soul contract, and it's hard for them to understand. They want to try to keep this person alive no matter what. And he said, he just complimented me on being so very graceful about and being willing to, support Rick and do what's best for Rick, as opposed to maybe what might be best for me, which is, wanting to hang on to him no matter what. So being able and willing to let go of him was, and allow Rick to, to do this, to have this agreement and to work this out between himself and his maker, so important. So I wanted to thank you for bringing that up and to emphasize, yes, that's one of the best things that we can do, is to really tune into, this other person and allow that person, whoever's in the midst of transition, to allow them to have dignity through this process. And as far as taking care of ourselves as caregivers, I was there at the hospital 24/7, and it was days before I even went out and had a shower. And yet at the same time, I was very aware that I wasn't going to, especially because of our daughter, I was aware that if I didn't take care of myself, it was going to be impossible for me to do anything for her or for Rick. So I made sure that I made requests from other people. I said, could you bring me some food? Could you, bring me some clothes? Could you do this? And as much as I have not made requests or asked for support in my life in other areas, I guess because of the extraordinary circumstances, I was very willing to make requests of others to help me. And they loved it, because the thing about it is that the other people around us, they don't know what to do. A lot of times they don't know how to support us. They want to be able to be there for us. And so the best thing that we can do is really to tune in to ourselves as caregivers and say, what do I need? And then start making requests, because then we allow the other people to truly support us and truly help us. And that also helps them in their being able to handle what's going on with the situation, you know, when a person is in transition in some way or another, you know, or in the dying process. So I would absolutely, I've continued to actually be better at making requests for what I need now as a result of that. And I would absolutely encourage everyone, regardless of, you know, what loss that they're experiencing or where they are, to be willing to allow other people to help and to really to think about what they need and to make those requests so that people can be doing things that that truly serve everyone. So it's a great question, and I believe that, you know, being able to ask yourself, what do I need? What do I want? And then make requests and allow other people to help is the best way that we can support ourselves as caregivers.
Because that is such a tough role. We can easily get lost because the focus is on the other person. Deb, but we need to take a quick commercial break. But before we do, could you give your contact information if somebody's listening right now and they're interested in your book or if they're interested in more about you? How would they find out more?
Well, everything, every way to contact me, my phone number, my email, et cetera, is on my website, and that is creativehearts.com. So it's creativehearts with an F.com, and I would love to hear from people.
Wonderful. Well, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and Beth, when we come back, I'd like to hear how you walked through the second death of your husband, how that differed from the first. So if you don't mind, we'll take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back with Deb Adamo.
So you think you're tough enough for Tough Talk with Tony Gambone? Tony knows how to dish it out. Can you take it? Tony Gambone is a communicator, mentor, and entrepreneur whose tough style and generous spirit quickly garnered recognition in many a competitive arena. Now he's bringing his intelligence and knowledge to you as a hard-hitting radio talk show host and thought leader. Tune in and see for yourself. Tough Talk with Tony Gambone. It's a sure thing. To find out more, go to Tough Talk with Tony Gambone.
Tune in every Thursday morning at 9 a.m. to Tough Talk Christian Radio with Tony Gambone. Tough Talk Christian Radio is for those who want to share and receive expressions of faith that will help you take the next step in your relationship with Christ. Listen in to hear from others about their experiences of faith and the love of Christ. Call in to share your experiences at 347-989-1363. Learn more by going to toughtalkchristianradio.com.
Welcome back to Lost and Starting Over. This is Linda Ballesteros, and my guest today is Beverly Adamo. She has been talking to us about her husband's death and his first death. That's right, his first death, because he died twice. So, Bev, when you talked about how you lost him the first time, how did it differ when he passed away 3 years later?
Well, thank you, Linda. So the first time was a very sudden death. He was here 1 minute, gone the next, and then through the process, you know, fought his way back to life from that death experience. The second time, what happened was he'd been getting weaker and weaker, and he had experienced some physical issues, and there was a possibility that he could have some surgery that would help him to have a better quality of life. Because as it was getting to where he would be pretty much an invalid if he didn't have the surgery. And the anesthesiologist who initially was slated to help with the surgery said, no, absolutely not, I won't do this. To put him under would be to kill him, and I won't do it. And we talked to our health provider, And the head of the anesthesiology department talked to us, and we made, I guess we made a really good case, because the head of the department said, you know, I will do this for you. If this is what you want, I will do this. Because Rick and I decided, I mean, he decided, and I supported him, I should say, in that, you know, if he didn't have a quality of life, what's the point? So we decided to go ahead with the surgery. And on November 13th, we went into the hospital, and Rick had a surgery, and he actually came through that surgery. It was touch and go, but he did come through it. And then again, I'm here at the hospital 24/7, and we spent the next 27, 28 days, whatever it was, in the hospital. And at a certain point, I could tell that it wasn't going to get any better. As a matter of fact, it was going the other way. So while Rick was still pretty coherent, his cardiologist, who's an amazing man, came in and we all talked. And I asked the cardiologist, you know, the tough questions. And Rick was making decision about whether or not he was going to stay or going to go, literally. And after we finished the discussion, Rick looked at me and he looked at his doctor and he said, okay, let's do this, meaning that he was ready to go. So we brought in the people who, like, I don't know what, he had a defibrillator that was in his chest that designed to restart his heart if anything ever happened. And so I think probably the hardest part was when the technician came in and turned that off. That was probably the most, okay, this is really going to happen moment. And when that happened, I was just said, it really is. So the next day, then we arranged for Rick to come home. And it was an amazing experience, though, nonetheless, because the last thing that he said coherently to when he was really here with us was to his daughter, I love you, and to me, I love you. And then he was transported here to the house. And by the time he arrived at the house, it was interesting because most of his personality was gone. There was only a little bit of him left. And that was on December 4th that he was transported home in the evening. And then by December 5th, he was in the last stages where he was literally dying. And at 4:44 p.m. on December 5th, with his daughter Kiara and his brother and sister-in-law and me here in his home, he passed for the final time. And it was so interesting because as his spirit left that final time, and I saw the clock right in front of me, and it did say 4:44, and to me, that's an angel number. Any repeating numbers are considered angel numbers. So at one point, I looked it up, and the bottom line of 444 is that all is well. It means all is well. And I love that final message that he left us with, is that, you know, all is well.
And because he had experienced death before, it doesn't sound like he was fearful, knowing that he was facing it.
Yeah, absolutely not. Not fearful at all, because he'd already been there. And as a matter of fact, like I said, when he came back, he was fearful about being back, not so much. So when it was time for him to leave again for the final time, no, there was no fear. And for my daughter and myself, no fear. I mean, certainly sadness. And yet at the same time, we'd had over 3 years to almost 4 years to really make sure that there were no regrets. I mean, that's the whole thing, is the quality of our life during that time, you know, knowing that any one of us could go at any time. I mean, we spent it in such a loving place of grace, because we, you know, not, the things that were important to us, they were, it was all about love, and it, anything else was just like, yeah, you know, doesn't make that much difference. So we were able to get through everything that was going on. And there were quite a few losses actually that happened right after he died. My best friend, Sandy, 30 days after he died, my best friend Sandy passed away unexpectedly. And of course, my daughter had gone off to college, so that was a loss in and of itself. And I was here in this big house where we raise our daughter by myself, and I ended up, you know, letting go of that. And then the other major loss at the time was with my mom, because she had started on her journey that the doctors called dementia, and so we had to make sure that she was safe and well taken care of. So there was a lot of loss that happened within, you know, starting with Rick's final death and until, you know, March of that year, with, like within 3 months. So there was a even more loss that came up. And I believe that my experience with death and with both deaths of Rick really allowed me to handle all of that into with much more grace and with much more knowing that everything was happening for a reason, and to be able to help others along the way, because that's one of the things that really supported me was during the time of all that quote unquote loss, I was talking to other people. There was a neighbor whose husband was terminally ill, and I was talking to her on an ongoing basis. You know, we were sharing our story of what had happened with different people, and being able to share all of that and to see the inspiration that other people experienced because of that, to see the comfort that other people experienced because of us sharing, me sharing the experiences, really helped me a lot. So it's something that I highly recommend to people who are experiencing loss.
And that is so true, Bev. We talked about this in the green room before the show started, is that being vulnerable and sharing, not, folks, I am not talking about sharing all of the details, the personal details, but what I'm saying is when you allow others to know that you're going through something, for one, it allows them the opportunity, like Bev had pointed out, to help. Even though our inclination is not always to ask for help, but if you allow others to help, it is their way of giving back. So by not allowing that, then you have pushed them, taken away their opportunity for them to expand their heart. I would never want to do that to anybody. Now, Bev, have all of this loss, and there have been some big challenges for you in the last few years or so. What is next for you? How do you start over? How do you start over? What's next?
Well, I have a big smile on my face as you were asking me that. As I said, I'm writing another book, The Fourth Reason, which will really talk about the second death and all of the other loss that happened and how to handle that and how to, it's really about, it's not just seeing is believing, it's more the opposite. Believing is seeing. So through this whole process and what I'll be talking about in the next book is how really my belief, my faith, my knowing that everything happens for a reason has helped me to expand my experiences here on this planet while I'm here, and also to be a service to others in writing these books and speaking. I love to speak. You know, thank you so much for having me on the show, because this is one of the ways in which I share my experiences and serve others. And that's really what's next for me, is to continue to be of service, to help people, to empower people, to support others in knowing that that they're really, that everybody's here for a purpose, and that they're living on purpose already, even if they don't change anything they do. And at the same time, when we become more aware of who we are and what we're doing, life just becomes so magical. It becomes so amazing, no matter what is happening, no matter how tragic any of the circumstances in our life are, we can really rise above that. So what's next for me is to continue to be of service in however that looks, you know, continuing to write, to continuing to speak, continuing to be a coach, a leader of different groups and programs and women's retreats, some of the things that I've already been doing. And sometimes when people ask me, well, what do you do? My answer to them is whatever I'm told, which is really what's next for me. Is I'm very open to spirit, and whatever comes up for me, and wherever I'm led, even though sometimes it's a little crazy, it's like, you want me to do what? Okay. But whatever comes up for me, that's what's next for me. And I'm really excited about the rest of my life, because I know that there are so many people out there who have already been inspired and comforted and helped. And I look forward to being able to be a resource for others as I continue forward.
And that's beautiful, Bev, because what I felt is every step that I took after Mario passed away was building my life. I could not recreate the life that he and I had. So for me to go back and create that was never going to happen. So I had to create a life that was neat to me by myself, and to live it in a way that he would be proud. I still don't know what that totally looks like, but like you said, I just have to do what I'm led to do, and you know, just know that it's the right thing. So it is difficult, but I tell you, when you're still living, that means you still are not done, and there's more for us to do. So I just kept going back to that. Now, we have our final three questions, but before we do that, Bev, would you give everybody your contact information again? I want to make sure they have that so they can either get a copy of your book, find out more about your coaching, or what you're doing.
Absolutely. Everything about me, including my book, et cetera, if it's not on my website, I'm happy to answer questions. And my website is creativehearts.com. That's creativehearts with an S. .com.
Okay, so the final three questions. The first one is, what one thing has helped you the most when dealing with your loss or with helping others?
The one thing that has helped me the most is my faith, because when I am in faith, I cannot be in fear, I cannot be in doubt, I cannot be in anything. And faith, what that means to me is knowing that everything's happening for a reason, I'm here for a reason, and that I am always being divinely guided.
And, you know, Bev, I had, I don't know about you, but during my journey with Mario, I had to remind myself of that sometimes, not just daily, hourly, but every minute. I had to remind myself of that, because fear does creep in. And we wouldn't, you know, we're human, so it's natural to go to fear because it's such a big, loud emotion. So would you agree that it is something that you have to practice every single day?
Absolutely, and that's a great, great, great point, because faith is a choice. It isn't a, you know, a belief or a done deal, or, you know, you make this decision and then you're always in faith. Not at all. It's a moment-to-moment choice, and that, to me, is what life is all about. It's, you know, one of my quotes is, it's not about time, it's about choices, and one of the choices that I make on a minute-to-minute basis is to be in faith. So, yes, absolutely good point, and it does take our, you know, willingness to do that.
Well, the next question is, how can a friend or a family member help someone who is struggling with a loss out there? What kind of advice could you help those that are supporting someone going through a loss?
Well, definitely be willing to listen. And by listening, that means, because sometimes we want to fix, and it's not so much about fixing as it is about listening. So if someone's going through a loss and there's something going on, I, with the people that I know that is going on, what I do is I ensure that they know that I'm here to listen. I'm here to hear whatever they have to say, and I show them by actually listening and not, you know, trying to make tell them what to do or anything like that, simply listening and being there. One of the things that people kept trying to do for me was feed me. It's like, well, I don't really need all that food and everything. So what helped me was when people asked me specifically, you know, what can I get for you, or what can it, and being a little more specific rather than you know, making an assumption that they knew what I needed. And sometimes when, and being willing to accept that sometimes I didn't really need anything. It was like, thank you. I really so appreciate that you're there for me, and I don't need anything right now. So it's, and to continue, you know, even when somebody says no to you, I don't need anything, you know, check back with them, because there were a lot of times when I would say no to someone and then all of a sudden, yes, I would need this. So not taking anything personally, you know, but not taking a no personally, I don't need, you know, no, I don't need any help personally, but to continue to show that you're there for them in whatever way that they need, and to not make any assumptions, just to be willing to be there and continue to be there and be unconditional as possible.
That is really great advice, you know, because so many times people, like earlier, they don't know what to do. But just making an offer and letting the person know, if you do need it, don't hesitate to let me know. Now, you may not need it right now, but please reach out and I'll check back with you. So just let me know in the future. But doing it in an unintrusive way. Texting is beautiful for that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
And, you know, sometimes just texting someone and say, I'm thinking about you. Oh, my goodness, that's all I needed sometimes.
Absolutely, yes. And I love social media as well, because that was a way for people to express thoughts and feelings and prayers and everything, and I didn't necessarily have to respond. I could simply, you know, take it all in, and that was amazing. I really appreciated that as well.
Absolutely. So the final question here is, since loss is something that we're going to all experience, and is there anything that we can do? Is there anything the listeners can do to kind of better equip themselves with a future loss, whether it is a death or whether it is a loss of a job? What kind of advice would you give someone today that would help them with any loss of the future?
Well, I was, for a lot of years, I think decades, when I was young, I was clinically depressed. And one of the, as I made that recovery out of that deep, dark hole, one of the things that I learned was something that I think can help anyone in all circumstances, really. But what I learned was that our feelings, how we're feeling, that's equal to our circumstance plus our thoughts. So whatever the circumstance is, and in this case, if we're talking about a loss of anything, whatever the circumstance is, we can change what we think about something, and then that in turn will change our feelings. So when we experience loss, instead of automatically, you know, thinking or going into some of these places where we have these feelings of you know, anger and sadness and everything else, which all have... I'm not saying don't experience that. I'm saying at some point, though, know that anytime something happens, a loss happens, when you change your thinking about that loss, you can change how you feel about it. So, for example, that's what got me out of my depression. That's what's helped me through all the losses that I've experienced, you know, twice, my husband dying twice, is knowing that at some point when I when I could change what I was thinking about the circumstance. For example, that this is happening for a reason, or that there's a divine purpose in this. And when I started thinking in that way about the loss, then my feelings were completely different about what was going on. So know that no matter what the loss or circumstance is, when you want to, you can change what you're thinking and change your feelings and how that's affecting you.
Now that's great advice, because it is, that is something that we can control, is our thoughts. And folks, like Deb says, she's not telling you not to feel it. It's just that when you start adding in maybe a thought or two a day that is more positive, then it can help you from being stuck. Because what does happen, and I found with myself, is that it's very easy to get stuck in the grief of it. And
yes,
to pull yourself out of that grief, you have to shift your thinking. It certainly doesn't mean that you miss them any less, but it does mean that you've decided to live and move on. So, you know, that is great advice, because it certainly helped me times, is just shifting my thinking.
Well, thank you,
so,
Linda.
Absolutely. Well, Bev, I want to thank you again for being on the show today and sharing your experience. And I know that there are people out there that will certainly find benefit in this. And folks, again, visit her website. That's creativehearts.com, creativehearts with an S.com. You'll find out more information about Beverly, her book, and anything, any of her coaching practices, so be sure to reach out to her. So again, Bev, thanks so much for being on the show today.
Thank you, Linda. It's an honor.
Well, folks, you know, I always leave you with a quote. So today the quote is, stop dying your death and start living your life. And that is a quote from Bev Adams. So be sure to check out her website and her book and her future books as well. Again, I want to thank you all so much for spending some time with me today, and I look forward to seeing you next time.
This has been an episode of Lost and Starting Over, a weekly show on the Tough Talk Radio Network. Remember that whatever you're going through, you don't have to go through it alone. We're here to help. Come back next week for another episode of Lost and Starting Over with Linda Ballesteros. Thank you for listening.